Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back on Monday. The UN says the world is failing to contain Ebola in West Africa. The U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State militants increases airstrikes on a Syrian border town, and new concerns about sagging global economic growth. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Paul Danahar of the BBC, Jennifer Griffin of Fox News, and Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number. It's 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email anytime at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, Jennifer, on Thursday, just yesterday, President Obama authorized the Pentagon to call up reserve troops in addition to the troops that have already been authorized to go to West Africa to try to deal with this Ebola crisis. What does this mean? Do we know how many people we're talking about?
Well, what this means, Susan, is that the president had to give an executive order in order to call up the reserve and National Guard, but it still falls under the 3,900 troops that the Pentagon had already authorized. So Secretary of Defense Hagel had announced, and the president had announced, that 3,900 U.S. troops could go to fight Ebola in West Africa. Already on the ground, there are 450 there, but they needed this execute order in order to move forward with some of the reservists who are the logistics experts, the engineers and others that they're needing. They're basically having to build the infrastructure. They have been working since they got there a month ago on simply building a 25-bed hospital in the capital. It has taken this long. They are supposed to begin building 17 treatment centers. They haven't even begun that because the rains are so bad. We talked to Major General Daryl Williams, who is heading the operation for the U.S. military, yesterday, and they said in some places they're having to use machetes to go through the jungle. The rains have stopped them from doing much. They're having to start from scratch there.
You know, that does not sound like the kind of urgent response that you might expect, Jonathan, from a situation that seems so dire there.
Well, the UN has said, and experts have said, that the international response has lagged. And I think that there's no doubt that the UN, the WHO, World Health Organization, underestimated for quite some time the breadth of this disease, the urgency of this epidemic. And just the other day, there was a briefing to the UN Security Council from the UN's top expert, where he's saying that at the rate that the disease is now, the outbreak is now proceeding, there could be as many, at least by the end of December, of 10,000 new cases a week, and that the world basically has 60 days in which to try and contain this outbreak.
How has the world responded, Paul?
The world has been pretty useless. I mean, if you look back in March, MSF came out of West Africa and said, we've got to take this seriously. And their fears were played down by the WHO. It was kind of ridiculous, because what they were looking at was an Ebola virus in countries that have been devastated by civil war. If you look at the reaction to this virus in places like Nigeria, where they've almost eradicated it because they have a functioning central government, it may be a chaotic one, but it works, and how it's been treated in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, where you just don't have that infrastructure where you can build on a foundation to react to this. And because of that, it was obvious it was going to go badly wrong, and the international community kind of sat back to see how bad it got before it got involved.
President Obama had to use the meeting on Tuesday, where he was meeting with the 21 heads of defense ministers chiefs who had come to Andrews Air Base to talk about ISIS, to try and rally international support for the Ebola efforts. And he told the countries that they are not doing enough. Germany, England, Italy, others. They are pledging that they will do something, but they say they don't have transport, and they can't even get their health workers there. There's fear in Europe that people will be bringing it back to Europe, and so they are really starting from scratch with this effort.
And indeed, the need for resources is so dire that you've had private foundations now. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has stepped up with a pledge of $50 million. The founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, is now kicking in 20 $25 million, and it's going to take a lot of money, a lot more personnel, and perhaps more involvement by other countries beyond the United States and the UK, who have both now stepped up with military assets to try and bring this outbreak, at least contain it, to the epicenter and not and prevent it from spreading further. And that's one of the great fears. You know, the WHO now is sort of kicked into action somewhat and is now deploying teams to states bordering this epicenter, these three West African countries that are at the epicenter of this outbreak, to try and at least get preventative measures into place and gear their health systems up to dealing with outbreaks should they indeed experience a fallout from a cross-border fallout from these three countries.
You know, Paul, it's not as though that if the rest of the world does nothing, Ebola will just be a problem in West Africa, right? I mean, this has all kinds of threats to the rest of the globe as well.
Yeah, and I think the thing about it is, Ebola's broken out before, but normally in very rural areas, often in Central Africa, and it hasn't got very far. You've got to basically be traveling around to really spread it. What's been different this time is it's got into the cities quickly, and therefore it's spread quickly. And you have, in places like Sierra Leone, in Freetown, panic because people don't know what to do with the bodies. They don't know what to do with their relatives that are sick. And I think the really worrying thing now is, even with all this extra aid coming in, what we're getting to a stage of is protecting the medical workers to send them back out again. It's almost like a kind of scene from World War Z where you have a military base with loads of barbed wire around it and people outside not being able to get in because the facilities are so limited to medical workers. You're going to see a lot of people dying, not being able to get treatment, but seeing treatment just over the fence.
This is obviously a humanitarian catastrophe in West Africa, an economic catastrophe for those countries as well. And I assume that then becomes a political catastrophe for those nations in West Africa that have been so hard hit, Jennifer.
Well, it's also a catastrophe. The reason this has become a national security priority for the administration, what it's been explained to us at the Pentagon, is that if these countries become failed states, and they are on the verge of some of them becoming failed states, that also they can be a breeding ground for terrorism and for groups that want to take advantage of the kind of breakdown of systems. And so it really leads to other issues that AFRICOM and the rest of the military has been dealing with in West and Northern Africa.
And it's not like this is the only global public health concern we're going to have. So the failure of the international organizations that are intended to deal with them has been pretty distressing.
Well, yeah, and I mean, look, there's been a reemersion of polio in Syria and in Iraq, and so these agencies are already overburdened. They're now having to respond to this, and we're just going to have to wait and see, as I said, see how many other countries step up to try and lend a hand to containing this outbreak. And of course, the fear is that it's, you know, we've already had several cases in Spain. You've had two cases here. And the fear is that I believe I saw a projection that said there's a 75% chance that it's going to emerge in France.
I think one of the things about this is it happened in Africa, and there is a bit of a temptation among the international community to kind of not get involved when it goes bad in Africa. When SARS was going around Asia, everybody got really worried. We've got polio on the European border, everybody's really worried. There's a bit of a kind of attitude in Africa. It all goes really badly wrong, but it tends to stay in Africa. There are wars, there are diseases. Let's only really get worried if it starts breaking out. The problem now is this got into city centres. The city centres have airports. The airports carry people out. And that's why this is different this time.
And there is this whole debate, Susan. There are Republicans on the Hill calling for closing off the border and stopping flights coming from West Africa. The president has said that won't stop people from flying to the United States, because what they will just do is they will lie about where they've been. They will fly to third countries, and it will spread that much faster. So there is this debate about whether you should halt commercial flights from West Africa. And it's really undetermined at this point.
In fact, it goes beyond that. You know, the UN's new human rights commissioner, Zayd Raad Al Hussein, had a news conference in which he expressed deep concern about the impact on human rights, on political rights, that crackdowns on containing the outbreak could produce in places like in West Africa, where, you know, there are concerns that they could criminalize the failure to report someone who's contracted the disease. And his point goes to what Jennifer was saying, and that is you then force people underground, and they hide the symptoms, they hide the fact that they've contracted the disease in order to get around these travel bans, in order to get around curfews, in order to get around measures that are designed to try and contain a disease, and what you end up doing is actually seeing it spread.
And the other thing about these particular countries is they have a culture that is very much driven by local traditions, local suspicions. You remember in the Sierra Leonean War, people used to run around with amulets. It was basically witchcraft to protect them against bullets. So you already have a community that's incredibly suspicious of government, incredibly suspicious of the outside world, and has a very firm set of beliefs about how to deal with issues on the ground. And these things are all clashing because basically you don't have a government that works, you have very suspicious people, and you don't have an infrastructure, and you have a really bad disease. It's kind of the worst case scenario.
You can only imagine the desperation of families who are living there now.
I mean, remember, the NGO community deserves criticism, but remember, when this started and when this broke out in June, there were only two doctors per 89,000 people in the province of Liberia where it started. There were no labs to test for this, and there are no ambulances to carry people.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the battle against Islamic State, and we'll take your calls and questions. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Paul Danahar. He's the Washington bureau chief for the BBC. He's the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. And Jennifer Griffin. She's national security correspondent for Fox News. She's the co-author of This Burning Land. And Jonathan Landay, senior national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Well, Jonathan, Islamic State militants may be retreating from the border town of Kobani in Syria. What is happening there?
Well, the fact is that the United States has been conducting more airstrikes to try and drive the Islamic State back from Kobani in Syria than it has against the Islamic State in Iraq. This Kobani, this Kurdish, Syrian Kurdish town near the Turkish border, has kind of become almost a symbol of a measure of how successful the United States will be in terms of leading this air campaign against the Islamic State. I'm not sure that that's actually going to be true, could be a true measure. But nevertheless, the word is that the Islamic State, having penetrated to a great depth inside the town, has been driven back. There are only reportedly holding a small piece of it now. They've lost control of the strategic hill that overlooks Kobani. So it appears that, at least for the time being, it has been prevented from capturing Kobani and extending its control of territory along the Turkish border with Syria.
So, Jennifer, does that mean that the airstrike campaign is working?
Well, look, the airstrikes only began seriously in the last week. In 2 days, they carried out 41 airstrikes, and that started to push the ISIS forces back. They also started coordinating last weekend, we've learned yesterday, with the Syrian Kurds on the ground, which the U.S. military had been reluctant to engage with because they are related to the PKK in Turkey, which are on the terror list. So I would say that Kobani is, frankly, an easy case for the U.S. military to, if you can't win in Kobani, you really aren't going to win anywhere. But it also indicates how complicated the situation is, because you have the Turks sitting on the sidelines, unwilling to get involved because it is Syrian Kurds involved on the ground. And the Turkish relationship there is really the key development this week in terms of, will they let the U.S. and others use their bases to begin going after ISIS?
Well, in fact, some U.S. officials said they had an agreement to use the base, and then the Turks said, no, you don't.
Yeah, the Turks have been a real fly in the ointment over this, and they have been all the way from the beginning of this conflict, because they couldn't make up what their policy was because they didn't know what they really wanted. The problem they really have is that they don't think anyone's listening to them. They want a war against ISIS and a war against Assad. And what they see is the world saying, hang on, we're going to deal with ISIS, that's what we care about. And of course, you know, America, UK are now saying it's an ISIS-first policy. That doesn't work for the Turks. So they've been playing brinkmanship. Their problem was the Western world and their journalists could see what was going on in Kobani. If it had been about another 10K over a hill, we wouldn't have been seeing so much about it. And everyone, if you look back at the Americans last week, the Pentagon, the State Department were all saying, if it falls, it's just one town, it doesn't mean very much. But it became a big issue because it became symbolic of the failures have been so far to do something sensible and serious in Syria to push back ISIS. So it inevitably became sort of something that they had to do, but it doesn't really tell us very much about what else they're going to be able to do when you get 20, 30K from the border. But
in fact, I think this actually became sort of this point of contention between the Turks, their president, President Erdogan, and President Obama, in that Erdogan comes out first and says, we're not going to do this, and you have to go attack Assad as well, and you have to support the creation of a buffer zone along our border with Syria where refugees can be kept. And I think, the president looked at this and says, you know what? We're not going to listen to him, and we're just going to go ahead and show the Turks that we can do this without them.
But
and I think just one other quick point, this question about U.S. use of facilities, there's no doubt that the Turks are allowing the United States to use quote-unquote facilities in Turkey, and those would include this sort of joint operations center along the border, there's CIA there, but contrary to what an American official said, who was accompanying Secretary Hagel on a trip, it doesn't include the main American base, military air base in Turkey that's in Sirlik, and I think the administration went to pains earlier this week to try and point that out.
Well, just to add to what Jonathan's saying, I think what it's become very clear that the Turks will allow surveillance flights to be flown out of drones to be flown out of Turkey, but not manned attack missions. And the really interesting thing was, why did it take the U.S. military and the coalition so long to get involved in Kobani? And it almost seemed at some point, Susan, as though they were waiting for the Turks to get involved. They were in negotiations. It seemed like President Erdogan had authorized the military to get involved. And then it became very clear that the army was going to stay on the border, not get involved. And the only reason that the Pentagon got involved was because it was being televised on cable news, frankly, on CNN and others. And I believe that that is what shamed them into, they realized this would be a propaganda victory for ISIS if it fell. And so that's when they stepped up the air campaign this week.
And I think that we may be on the verge of an even more tensions in the U.S.-Turkish relationship, because now it's emerged that a very senior U.S. diplomat met with a representative of this Kurdish, a Syrian Kurdish party that is very, very close to the PKK, which is on the U.S. terror list and is has been fighting for a separate Kurdish state in Turkey for the last 30 years. That is not going to make Mr. Erdogan happy.
And look at that. I mean, the Turks did the same thing in 2003. I mean, the Americans thought they had a deal with them over invading Iraq, and at the last minute, they messed it all up. So, I mean, it's not like they don't have form when it comes to dealing with America and trying to take action in the region.
And the other very interesting development is on the same day that the Turks said that the U.S. couldn't use their air bases, they sent their F-16s to fire on the PKK, which they hadn't done in 2 years, in Turkey near the Iraqi border. And it was almost to say, look, we have a Kurdish problem in Turkey. We know how to deal with it. And don't think that we're going to roll over on this issue.
The other big issue here is you have to look at what Turkey wanted. They wanted the Muslim Brotherhood to have a big role in a post-Assad Syria. And they've seen the Muslim Brotherhood, who are their allies and Qatar's allies, being rolled back to cross the region in Egypt, in Libya. And as far as they're concerned, when this all ends, they're getting nothing out of it. All their investment they made in the Brotherhood and the FSA and all these other silly little groups that have never really amalgamated into anything, they've got nothing out of it politically. So they're now saying, look, if you're going to drive this, we want to know where it ends and what we get out of it. Because so far, we can't see a horizon from Turkey's point of view where it's all worth any investment.
Right. What they see is a Kurdish state.
Right.
They see 30 million Kurds getting a state.
And in another sort of affront to the Turks, I think, in that regard, the United States has confirmed what we reported last month, which was the United States has cut all relationships with this kind of Muslim Brotherhood-dominated opposition that the United States helped create, that's based in Turkey, and the command of the Free Syrian Army, and has been dealing through the CIA directly with chosen commanders and groups both in the north and the south of Syria.
And that came out this week. I mean, Allen was giving a press conference, and he talked about how they're going to pull together elements of the FSA, which everyone interpreted, I think correctly, as saying the FSA, not that it really ever existed, but the umbrella group has been ditched. And then yesterday, Jen Psaki was saying, no, he didn't really mean that. He didn't really say that. But clearly, he did say that, and he did mean that, and that's what's going to happen.
Well, it may also be the reason that when we asked Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel who the head of the Free Syrian Army was or who the head of the Syrian opposition was, he didn't have a name.
President Obama met with senior military chiefs from 21 nations this week. You mentioned that earlier, Jennifer, because they ended up talking a bit about responding to the Ebola crisis. But it was really a meeting called to discuss the coalition strategy against ISIS, meeting at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. This was kind of unusual. Why did they feel it was necessary to have this meeting?
I think it was almost for domestic consumption here in the U.S. to show that the president was leading this coalition. It was a very public show. It was also a way to force the sometimes reluctant allies to come forward and say, okay, what are we going to do? Because right now, all of the coalition members have quite a few caveats. I mean, the European members are still not involved in airstrikes in Syria. They're not active in Syria. You have, in the early days, you had the Saudis and UAE and Qatar involved in airstrikes. But now it needs to move to the next stage. What is going to be done in terms of ground forces? It was also probably a way to get Turkey involved, and Turkey sent a lower-level representative than the other coalition members.
Paul. I think the thing to remember is that America hasn't wanted to lead during this crisis in Syria, and it's allowed everybody else to go their own way. And now they're trying to herd these cats back together again and form them into something that America can lead. So they've got a bit of a problem in the sense that if you allow different groups and different aspirations to just run wild for 2 or 3 years, getting them back together again, if they come from the Middle East where they don't like each other very much anyway, is very difficult. So you need a kind of PR exercise to say, look, guys, we're all sitting around in the same room. We do mean business, but I'd love to have been a fly on the wall during that meeting.
In fact, the only thing to come out of the meeting, as far as I can tell, is that they named the operation finally. They now call it Operation Inherent Resolve, which we had to wait a month for them to name. They had been reluctant to name it. We had been asking Pentagon officials about this, and it almost seemed as though they didn't want to name it, they didn't want to own it, they didn't want a historical bookmark for it, and now they've named it, and they've had this very symbolic showing out at Andrews Airport.
Doesn't the slowness, though, to assume leadership? I mean, if the United States doesn't lead, frankly,
Nobody else
leads. And the kind of the absence of leadership, doesn't it just fuel the problem that they now have to address once you decide you need to pull the coalition together, you need to get involved?
Well, I think that this is something that's been a long time. If you're going to not just, as the president says, degrade and eventually destroy the Islamic State, and in particular, create from the ground up, which is what we're now doing, a quote-unquote moderate Syrian opposition force. You need places to train them, and we know that's going to take place in Saudi Arabia, but I think they've been talking to the Turks about that as well. You need money, you need arms, and you need cooperation, because you need these groups, you need countries like, for instance, Qatar, which has been backing fairly questionable groups in terms of their political, their religious idea, Salafist extremist groups. You need them to stop doing that. You need people to come together on a common program.
I know Americans probably have the same reaction that President Obama seems to have, which is a real weariness about getting involved in a military conflict in that neighborhood again. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Before we do that, let's talk just for a moment about concerns about global deflation. Paul, tell us about this. Why is this suddenly an issue for the globe?
Well, we suddenly kind of woke up during the week and all the stock markets had gone down, which always upsets everybody. No one could really work out what it was. Some of it was talk about that the European economy was weakening, growth forecasts were down. It has got a little bit better. The U.S. industrial production has kind of pepped up a little bit, and so we've seen a bit of movement. But I think you can probably mix in some of that Ebola. You just have this kind of big uncertainty, and the thing about people in Wall Street is it's money. And so, therefore, they're not going to take chances. So you've got Ebola, you've got ISIS, you've got a bit of uncertainty in Europe, you've got the American figures were looking a bit ropey. So what do? You just sell, don't you, I guess?
Well, and you also had oil prices falling to a four-year low this week. Jennifer, why are oil prices going down? And does it tell us anything about kind of the state of the world?
Well, I think oil prices are at their lowest level in several years, $85 a barrel. That's down 25% since June, when it was at about $112 a barrel. This is showing that there is the economies are slowing down. Demand is slowing down. This is really the root of the jitters that you saw in Europe this week. There are concerns again about Greece. The bond rate the 10-year bond rate went to a high. That is not good. Fears of deflation. This tension between Angela Merkel and Germany and the austerity measures that they have tried to impose on the various economies in Europe. The tension with France and Italy and others who say, look, we need some stimulus. Can the European Commercial Bank deal with this? All of this is leading to a lot of uncertainty, as well as will Russia disrupt gas flow to Germany and others because of the Ukraine crisis? Putin is in Milan today for a meeting with Europeans and Asians, and that uncertainty is what is driving all of this these jitters right now.
Jonathan,
I think that there's an irony here. You ask, falling oil prices reflective of what's going on in the world today, and in fact, they're not, because once upon a time, when you would have had two wars in the Middle East, slowing economy in China, the United States economy is still somewhat fragile. You have Europe, which is still in the midst of an economic crisis, although it's dormant. It hasn't gone away. Usually, once upon a time, oil prices would go up. And in this case, they have come down. And I think one of the major reasons is because there is a glut of oil. The United States is producing more than it ever had. Leading producer now. It's going to increase the amount it's producing. Libya and oil have come back on the market. The fact is that the OPEC producers have not slowed down their production. So you have this glut. And that has contributed a great deal.
And there's a bit of a conspiracy theory about that, and that is that if the prices go down, then fracking becomes more expensive, and that may make people more nervous about investing in it. And fracking scares the pants off the Middle East.
Now, because this is a conspiracy theory. Who would be orchestrating this conspiracy?
Saudi Arabia.
Well, I think if you look at Saudi Arabia, their motivation right now is to keep their market share and to put pressure on Iran. And what's very interesting about these lower oil prices is that Russia and Iran need a high oil price. Russia needs $100 a barrel to balance their budget. Iran needs $130 a barrel. So they are under incredible economic pressure. The U.S. should be leveraging that right now for the Iran nuclear deal and for what they need to do to Putin to get with regards to Ukraine.
But this is also going to hurt Iraq. Iraq needs, I forget how much a barrel, but its budget is also based on the world price of oil. And so, you know, what you're seeing here is perhaps the beginning of this vicious cycle. And where it's going to end, we have to wait and see. But the markets have kind of stabilized now. The European Central Bank is now looking at measures to try at what the Fed has done here with by buying private and commercial bank equity. There's a major stress test that they're now doing on more than 100 European banks to see whether or not they have the assets to cover all the loans they've made. And you now have a division emerging in Europe between the Germans, who are, you know, the pro-austerity, driving the austerity measures that the Europeans have been implementing, and on the other side, you have France, you have the European Central Bank, and Italy saying, no, we've had enough of austerity.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll go straight to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Zurich, providing risk management and insurance solutions for those who truly love their business. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And by Staples, with cleaning and break room solutions for small business owners. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. This is NPR.
Ground control to Major Tom.
On the next Fresh Air, retired astronaut Chris Hadfield. He's probably best known for the YouTube video of him singing David Bowie's Space Oddity while floating around weightless at the International Space Station, which he commanded. He has a new book of photographs of Earth that he took from space titled You Are Here. Join us.
Ground control to Major Tom.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers, Jennifer Griffin of Fox News, Paul Danahar of the BBC. Let's go to the phones, take some of your calls and questions. We'll start with Terry. He's calling us from Alexandria, Virginia. Hello, Terry.
Good morning. Good to have you on the line with me. I just wanted to comment on the beginning part of your program. I do not feel our armed forces should be used to go into a contaminated, very serious disease country situation. If you look at our Constitution, it kind of outlines, as does the National Guard, constitution to each state of what our troops are for, and it's not to become medical people. I think it's very wrong. You give them money, give them know-how, give them everything you want, private contractors, you name it, but you don't see all these other nations running in with their troops.
All right, Terry, thanks so much for your call.
Terry, the Pentagon has gone to great lengths to say that the troops that they're sending are going to basically be building infrastructure. They're not going to be treating patients. There are a few exceptions to that. There are 2-3-man teams from Walter Reed that are, these are Navy specialists who are manning some of the laboratories, but they are in full chemical biowarfare suits, and they are not in any danger in terms of contamination. But I will say you're touching on one issue, and there is some frustration that I hear at the military level that many of the troops who do feel like they'd like to be deployed to fight ISIS and be those combat troops that are needed perhaps to call in airstrikes in the fight in the Middle East, they wonder why they're being deployed to West Africa. However, the Pentagon says they will not come into contact with those who have been infected.
Paul?
I think the thing is that the West tried not to get involved. It sat back and watched what happened. And I think we've now got to a stage where you, either you go to the disease and sort it out, or the disease is going to come to you.
And I think, I believe that the United States is not the only military that's involved there. I believe the UK, the United Kingdom, is going to be sending something like 750 troops, a Navy ship, and some helicopters to also help out.
Now, here's an email we got from Matt. Matt writes, I'm a military service member preparing to go to West Africa as part of our nation's Ebola assistance mission. I've also traveled to West Africa. I'm very proud of our president for investing our people and resources in this effort. I would like to specifically address a comment just made by a panelist about treatment centers turning into a scenario reminiscent of World War Z. This kind of comment is exactly what our media outlets must avoid to preserve a sense of rational, informed calm. The average American until recently did not know where Sierra Leone was on a map or what Ebola was, and is already primed to envision something from a movie. Do not add to this tension by drawing comparisons to a fictional zombie apocalypse. Well, Paul, I think it was you.
That was me, yes. Yeah. Well, I've been to Sierra Leone as well, and Liberia, and I saw what it was like when they were running the UN camps, the peacekeepers, and it was rather like that. They were basically locking themselves into little camps and trying to avoid getting dragged into a really messy war. So I've seen how badly things can go in Sierra Leone. The point I was trying to make was, The people on the ground, people who work for the BBC and the Africa Service, are saying to us, the way this is going is they're moving towards an isolation type scenario there, where they basically say, look, we can't cope with everybody, so guys, you know, try and deal with it as best you can in isolation areas. But to actually, what they want to focus on are the medical teams, because that's got to be the priority to send them back out again.
And let me just say our thanks to Matt for his service to his country and in this effort.
And it's interesting because AFRICOM Commander General David Rodriguez pointed out that if in the next few weeks or months they can get 70% of those infected into hospitals, then they believe that they can start bringing the numbers down. That's what they're aiming for, and that's why the race to build these hospitals and treatment units so that you can isolate them from the larger population, and that's what the U.S. military is going to be involved in, not in the treatment of these patients.
That 70% number comes from the U.N. That's what they were told the other day, that within the next 2 months, they've got to get a target of 70% of the people into treatment centers, as well as 70% of the funerals being conducted where you don't have contact with the body, which is a tradition in that part of the world.
And if you've got 10,000 people a week, I think that was the statistic they were talking about.
They're projecting for December,
then,
is it not controlled?
If you don't deal with it, then you really will have a scenario where you've got people trying to kind of deal with just a tidal wave of deaths. And now, that would be incredibly difficult to manage.
Florence is calling us from Burtonsville, Maryland. Florence, I understand you're from Sierra Leone yourself. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for calling the Diane Rehm Show. What comment did you want to make?
Well, my comment to the show is the panelist said it threatens the security of the country and the outside world, and then people do keep the bodies inside because people are dying of malaria, cholera, typhoid or other kind of diseases. So my advice to the international world, if they're going to build up a center, they should have a particular ward or particular section that does triage and educate the people and tell them, instead of you keeping the bodies at home, if you are sick of any of these diseases, come to us. We will treat you. So then they won't get the fear of keeping the bodies in the houses. And like I say, it threatens the security of outside world and other the country, because people do when they don't have money, and these Arab states would come and convince them and show them money, and then terrorists and all these things will grow in that part of the world. So that's my own take, and that's my advice.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Florence.
I think Florence has a very important point, that education and public service announcements in these countries are going to be crucial in terms of getting a handle on this. There has been one bright light in the last week, and for the first time, the U.S. began testing a vaccine on human beings. It started up at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Silver Spring, Maryland. On Monday morning at 9:15, they injected 39 healthy volunteers with this vaccine. It came from Canada. It's the first time they've done this testing. This is a step towards making progress. It's going to be a long road, but it's the first time they've tested a vaccine.
But I think also, if you look at, I mean, Nigeria, which should have been a really, really bad case, if you look at the infrastructure of the country, has managed to almost eradicate Ebola.
And how did they, why were they able to do that when it proved to be impossible in these other, in the West African countries?
Well, they were incredibly efficient at basically identifying everyone who may have been in contact with someone who died, and then the people that may have been in contact with them, and then the people that may have been in contact with them. It got up to about 800 and something people, and they just slammed them into isolation, and they kept them there for 21 days. They stopped them moving around. And as long as you've basically dealt with it within 21 days and those people don't meet anybody else, it stops. And they were incredibly efficient. They were basically, what they did was they had a group of medical officers ready to do with a different disease, and they swapped them over. So they had a team ready, and they just pounced, and they dealt with it quickly, and it's pretty much gone.
We should Nigeria put the Nigerians...
Also, they also have a functioning public health system, whereas these other countries don't.
We might need to send the Nigerians down to Texas Presbyterian.
Yeah. It was 6 months ago this week that we saw that terrible story about all those girls in Nigeria being taken away, kidnapped by an Islamic militant group. I remember it so well. I was on the news. I was guest hosting the news roundup that day, and we knew nothing about the fate of these 200 girls. Today, just as we were coming on the air, reports of a ceasefire, an encouraging sign. Paul, what is happening?
Yeah, the Nigerian Chief of Defense, Alex Bade, said that they'd reached a ceasefire agreement. Part of these discussions were going to always be about releasing these 270 schoolgirls. It's very difficult to know what it actually means on the ground. Does it mean that they have a ceasefire and then Boko Haram keeps to hold the territory that they already have, and in return they give up the girls, they get back some of their soldiers? It doesn't really tell us long-term where this conflict is going. I mean, Boko Haram have themselves identified themselves with people like Islamic State. They're not exactly moderating and changing their stripes. So it's going to be a very difficult one to see where this goes. Is it going to be a temporary thing? The girls come back? And then will Boko Haram carry on doing the same things all over again?
The problem is we've heard these kind of things from the Nigerian military and defense chief in the past. We have not heard yet from Boko Haram. We've not heard from this Abu Bakr Shekau. Is he alive? Is he dead? Is he in agreement that there's a ceasefire and that the girls will be returned? I think that I would treat this with skepticism.
Well, we haven't forgotten the girls who were kidnapped, and we hope that they'll be able to come home at some point soon. Let's go to Tony. He's calling us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Tony, thanks for holding on.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is on ISIS. We were talking about, or the panel was talking about, the airstrike success they've had in Kobani. And I think that success is really the combination of the Kurds really fighting alongside the U.S. airstrikes to make that work and make that a winning situation. Why aren't we doing the same thing in Iraq?
You know, John, that's a great question. Jonathan is nodding his head in agreement with
you. The flaw that people have been going on and on and on about in President Obama's strategy is the lack of ground troops. Well, in Kobani, there were ground troops. They were the Kurds, as you point out. In Iraq, there are also ground troops, but they're not of, in most places, of a caliber that are able to really capitalize on the much lower volume of American airstrikes that are going on inside Iraq. Don't forget, you had four complete divisions of the Iraqi military just collapsed overnight when, in mid-June, when the Islamic State launched its offensive that swept through Mosul and then down to almost the doorsteps of Baghdad. A couple of days ago, I believe it was last weekend, the situation on the outskirts of Baghdad were so dire that the Iraqi military had to ask the United States to send helicopter gunships to help their ground troops fight back the Islamic State, which was encroaching in such a way that it was almost in position to launch artillery into Baghdad International Airport. And so there's, you know, and let's not forget, Kobani is one small place where the fighters, the Syrian Kurds, have been fighting ISIS actually for quite some time in their part of Syria. And so there's a difference in the quality, I think, of both the ground troops as well as the scope of the fighting.
I think there's a difference in quality probably also of the ISIS fighters. Many of those that are fighting in Iraq actually are Sunni former members of the Iraqi army that were so fed up with the Shia government, as they saw it in Baghdad, that they joined ISIS because they wanted to basically kind of liberate their own areas. You've probably got a lot more people fighting for ISIS in Syria that are perhaps less trained. They're kind of foreign fighters that are fighting with them there. They may not have all those lovely new American weapons that ISIS captured in Iraq.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Jennifer, did you have a comment you wanted to make on this?
Well, I think it's not so much that the Iraqi armed forces are bad fighters. It's that they are unwilling to fight along sectarian lines. So you are finding that the troops that they send out continue to retreat. So they just ISIS just took over a very important training base in HIT in Anbar. We're hearing that Anbar is now almost 80% ISIS. And every time we turn around, we hear that the Iraqi armed forces are making a tactical retreat.
And I think that's a really good point. That brings the other to this other point, which is the perhaps the most proficient fighters on the Iraqi government side are Shiite militias trained and directed in some cases by Iran. And that stokes the sectarian divide in Iraq.
And they're carrying out, according to Amnesty International, their own abuses, kidnappings for ransom. And so you are seeing a replay of the kind of civil war-like conditions in Baghdad that caused this crisis.
We've been watching those pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong. Just today, hundreds of Hong Kong police officers began a surprise raid before dawn to remove barricades that the students and other protesters had erected. What direction is this protest going, Paul?
I think inevitably it will slow down. The thing about Hong Kong is there was a flurry a couple of weeks where people in Hong Kong were on board with this. Slowly over time, because it's a big industrial kind of area, I mean, big commercial area, people were beginning to lose money, beginning to get frustrated. They began to lose some of the support of the people of Hong Kong. Plus, you've got to remember that China has seriously got its tentacles into Hong Kong politically and particularly in the business world. So much money is made in Hong Kong because of the Chinese market. So it needed to have a real impact early. And the longer it's gone on, the weaker the opposition.
What is it exactly that the demonstrators want to see happen?
They want Beijing to compromise on its plan for having free and fair elections in 2017 for the city government. They say Beijing, under the agreement that it signed with Britain for the handover of Hong Kong in 1997, agreed to have one man, one vote, one country, two systems, where Hong Kong gets to have universal suffrage. Only the way the Chinese government wants this to go is that they want the nominees for the elections to be approved by and vetted by a government committee. And, Hong Kong people who have are saying, at least the students and the Occupy movement there are saying, no, we think anybody who wants to run should be allowed to run and shouldn't have to be vetted by Beijing.
Public anger erupted on Wednesday when there was a televised moment where a protester was dragged away in handcuffs. He was a rights activist, and he was pepper sprayed and kicked on the ground. It seemed at that point, the next day, the leader of Hong Kong agreed to meet with the leaders of the protests. It seemed like there was a breakthrough, and then we heard that he said that he would talk in principle with them, but that they that China would still be vetting any of the nominees who are running in the 2017 election.
What's been quite interesting about this demonstration is that, unlike in other parts of the world during the Arab Spring, for example, although the students were seen as the face of it, most of the real hardcore groups were late 20s, early 30s. They were people that basically had not got anything financially rewarding out of the system in Hong Kong. And many, many of them were going on the ground and saying, you know, I've got nothing out of this, so I want to see something. And that was driving it early on. Many of those people have now gone back to their day jobs.
Paul Danahar of the BBC, Jennifer Griffin of Fox News, Jonathan Lande of McClatchy Newspapers, thank you so much for being with us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Center.